Yeah, I'm Bill and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm sober tonight through the grace of God, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a lot of people like you and you for keeping me sober and teaching me how to stay away from one drink one day at a time, which I had an awful lot of difficulty doing back then. Most important thing first, I spilled some coffee on my shirt. Can anybody notice it? I told you, Bernadette. I wanted my wife to feel better. She worries about those things. And no, it's not because she's in Al-Anon. I wanna thank Jessica. That was marvelous. That really. The older I get, the more I cry, but you really touched me. And as I look out here and see all these young faces, I'm so grateful to God for bringing you in so early, you know? When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was the youngest in the room by probably 25 years. And I looked around and I said, what the hell am I doing here? But I'm glad. I didn't stay, but I came back, and I'm glad I'm in here tonight. And by the way, I may be 70 on the outside, but I feel like I'm 30 on the inside. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous does for you. Keeps you forever young. Forever young. I'd like to also congratulate the people celebrating their birthdays tonight. They show all of us that this program works. This program not only works, it works tremendously well. To be around here for a while and to watch all the miracles that take place in this room has been an incredible experience. One I never anticipated. But I'd say, you know, you don't have to go to the movies if you really want to see excitement. You just got to come to an AA meeting and watch people either die or grow, you know, because that's what happens here. We either die or we change and grow. The middle part might be we might exist for a while, but I had that life and I don't want to wish it out on anybody, you know. But anyway, I want to thank Bob for inviting me out. I enjoy your friendship very much. I enjoy being with you and Sheldon down in Florida. And thank you for asking me to bring Bernadette, my lovely wife, who just reminded me that tonight is the night that we eloped and got married 51 years ago. Yeah. Because I was drunk at the time, but what the hell, you know? Oh, man, alive. Oh. How the hell did you put up with this, Bernadette? I don't know. Thank God, though. You saved my life. And thank you, Bob, for bringing me to that detox meeting this afternoon. I just really enjoyed it so much. Going to meetings like that, is, if you can't keep your memory green anywhere else, boy, you keep it green there, you know. And I shared a little story while I was there, and I'd like to share it tonight because there are some newcomers, right? There's some newcomers here tonight, and maybe some people coming back, you know. And sometimes when we come back, we think that's an option, you know, that we can always come back. I've known a lot of guys in my time. By the way, my sobriety date is April 8th, 1962. And that's, yeah, I got sober when I was 9. I don't know what the hell you're laughing at, but I still lie a lot, but not as much as I used to, you know. But anyway, I was sharing that on a recent trip, I picked up the Reader's Digest, and I love to read that, you know, laughter is the best medicine section, you know. And it was this story about these three guys who went on vacation together. And one of them happened to be an alcoholic. And they went and they toured all kinds of places and saw all kinds of things. And on the way back, the alcoholic seemed like he had a resentment. And his friend said, well, what's your problem? He said, well, we didn't see my place. I want to see that new brewery they just built. They said, okay, well, let's go see it. So they went to visit the new brewery. And as they were touring the new brewery, they were walking around and the thing above the vats. And the alcoholic started smelling the beer being mixed in the vat. And as he leaned over too closely, he got so intrigued, he fell into the vat. So they rushed the two friends outside so they can save him. About a half hour went by. And his friends got no words. Finally, they knock on the door, and the engineer comes to the door. And they said, what happened to our friend? Is he okay? The engineer said, I'm sorry, I got bad news for you. Your friend died. So he died? Oh, my God. Did he suffer very much? The engineer says, I don't think so, because he crawled out three times to take a leak before he finally drowned, you know. And I laughed. I thought, you know, yeah, it's a funny story, you know. And then as I'm flying along, I start thinking about it. And I say, hell, that's the story of my life. I was constantly crawling out of the vat. Without knowing that how many times I was going to be able to crawl out of the vat before I drowned. And so I like to say to particularly the newcomers or anybody who's coming back, you know, we don't know how many chances we get to crawl out of the vat. So it's much easier to stay out than it is to go back. Anyway, I don't mean to be a philosopher, but I just got that second thought about that story, you know. Anyway, I'm Bill, and I am an alcoholic, and I come from an alcoholic family. This is a family disease. I was talking with Tom before the meeting, and we were sharing about that. But I didn't know anything back then as a young man about alcoholism. Nobody did. I mean, my father had six brothers, and five of them died from what we now know as alcoholism. My grandfather, Archibald McClintock. Hell, you had to be an alcoholic with a name like that, you know. But I didn't know he was an alcoholic. I mean, even when he would come, he worked on the docks. And he would bring home the strangest things to my grandmother's house. You know, I used to go to their house, because when I was going to grammar school, I used to go to their house for lunch, because it was a shortcut. And one day I got there, and my grandfather had brought home a monkey from the docks. And my grandmother was chasing the monkey around the room with a broom. The monkey was swinging along the curtains on the windows. I thought it was funny until she screamed at me, and my grandfather was sitting on the couch drunk and laughing like hell, you know. And she says, you can laugh all you want, but when I get this monkey, you're next, you know. So that was alcoholism, but I didn't know it, you know. My father was an alcoholic. His father was an alcoholic. Anyway, I didn't have much of a chance, I guess. But the only time the only alcoholic I ever knew was when I'd be driving in a car with the family, and we'd be somewhere in the city, and some guy would be stumbling down the street, you know, with a gray overcoat and a brown bag with a pint in it, and somebody would say, oh, there's an alcoholic. So in my mind, that's what an alcoholic was, a Bowery derelict. Bowery derelict. And maybe that's why for all the years that I drank, I didn't consider myself an alcoholic, because I never considered myself a Bowery derelict. Anyway, I grew up, I went to school. I thought, when I was a young man, I thought I had a vocation. I wanted to be a priest. And so I went away to a seminary to study until they found out about me, and then they decided that no. In fact, my spiritual director said to me one day, I think, Bill, you might make a wonderful father, but not in this place. So I came out of the seminary into the world. In the seminary, they call us the world, because this is where all the pretty women are, you know. And so I came out, and I have to tell you, I do remember coming home, and I was a nervous wreck, uptight. I had always been an uptight guy, you know, and when you shared with me at meetings about, you know, low self-esteem and about not measuring up and those feelings, that's what I first began to identify with, the feelings that all of us alcoholics have in common. And I had all of them from a kid up. When I took my inventory and thought back, and that's the way I was when I was a kid. I was uncomfortable in a crowd of more than two, you know. I mean, I just, you know, I was a good student, but I didn't think I was as good as. I was a good athlete. I didn't think I was as good as. I never thought I measured up. So I came out into the world, and I got a job as a copy boy for a newspaper in New York City. It was at that time, this was 1950, 51, and it was then the flagship of the Hearst organization. It was the largest evening newspaper in the world at the time. And I was going to St. John's University in Brooklyn, New York, to try to finish up my college education. And I broke a story. Without going into any details, I uncovered a story, which was a big story. And they made me a newspaper reporter. I was 18 and a half years old. I got a real lucky break. And they sent me over to Brooklyn, where I was born, to cover police headquarters on what they call the lobster shift. That's midnight till 9 o'clock in the morning, which was when most things happen in Brooklyn anyway. You know, it's that kind of a borough. And I said to the city editor, well, what do I do? And he says, just go to Brooklyn and meet the other reporters, and they'll tell you what to do. They'll break you in. Back then, there were 18 newspapers in the city of New York. It was a big newspaper town. It was the heyday of journalism. It was the days of Walter Winchell and, you know, all that. So I went to Brooklyn and became a police reporter. I got to Brooklyn and I asked the lieutenant on the desk where I could find the other reporters. And he pointed across a big thoroughfare called Flatbush Avenue to a bar on the corner called the Edison Bar and Grill. And he looked and he said, you'll find some of the reporters in the Edison Bar. He was wrong. I found all the reporters in the Edison Bar and Grill, you know. And I walked in and I asked the bartender to introduce me to one of the reporters. He introduced me to Charlie Feeney of the Daily Mirror. Charlie was about 60 years old. I was 18 and a half. And I told Charlie, I just started, and he put his arm around me and he says, what are you drinking, kid? I said, I don't know. He said, okay, well, how about a shot and a beer? I said, that's fine. So I had a shot and a beer. Charlie told me what he did, how he read the slips and called the precincts and so on. And then Charlie introduced me to Joey George of the Daily News. Joey put his arm around me. Joey's only, he was younger, he was about 55. And he told me what he did, and he said, what are you drinking, kid? I said, I don't know, whatever Charlie had. How about a shot and a beer? Fine, I had a shot and a beer. And then Joey introduced me to Charlie Mortimer of the New York Times. Charlie put his arm around me. They were having a lot of fun, you know. They were passing the kid down the bar, you know. I walked in the Edison Bar and Grill. It was midnight. And I staggered out at 4 o'clock in the morning, a veteran newsman. That's what I felt like. I felt like I was a veteran newsman. Knew it all. Somewhere along that bar, something happened to me. And I'm not making this up, being melodramatic, because it happens to all of us, right? Remember your first drunk? I began to feel comfortable. I began to feel at ease. I no longer was afraid to talk to these galoots. I started talking back. It was like all of a sudden, wow, I felt like I always wanted to feel and never could feel, you know? And that's what happened to me on my first drunk. I only remember good things, wonderful things. Because from then on, before I started to do anything, I had a drink before I started. I mean, if I was going to go to a dance with the guys, I had a few drinks and got ready to go to the dance. So by the time I get there, I could ask a girl to dance, you know? And then if I had enough drinks, I could ask her to go on a date, you know. And if I had enough drinks, I could actually take her on the date, you know. Without knowing it, without even thinking about it, it came so natural. I now know I was an alcoholic in waiting. I had all the character defects and shortcomings, all of the characteristics of an alcoholic long before I picked up that drink. And now this magic elixir gave me life. Life as I had never known it before. And it was marvelous for a long time. Quite a long time, maybe. As I say, before I did anything, I had a few drinks. And so I became I was an alcoholic. Boom, right off the bat. I was a daily drinker, weekend drunk. And I began to advance in my career. They promoted me. They found out I could write. So I started covering criminal courts in New York City, major court trials. Then he sent me to covered City Hall. Then he brought me in a nightside rewrite, writing stories for the first edition. Then I found I could really write, and he promoted me to dayside rewrite, where I was writing stories for seven editions. And then he really liked the way I wrote, and I made me a byline writer. And at the age of 22 years old, I was a byline feature writer for the largest evening newspaper in the world. At the age of 24 years old, I was the obituary editor for that same newspaper. Now, if you don't know what this is, there's a little bit of a difference between the two, you know. As a byline writer, I was traveling all around the country. I was, you know, I went down to Birmingham, Alabama, interviewed Authoring Lucy, who was the first black woman who was barred from going to the university by George Wallace. He held his hands across the doors, wouldn't allow the blacks in, you know. Big stories, covered the Sputnik, the last execution in Sing Sing Penitentiary, on and on. I'm sharing all this with you because, you know, wonderful things happen to us that this disease then begins to take away. It steals them from our life. It leaves no stone unturned in our life. And in the end, it takes our very life. And that was what was happening to me, and I had no idea. I was having too much fun to pay attention to it, really. How did I become the obituary editor? Because I got fired 5 times from that paper, all through to my drinking. I got fired for wrapping up my car, being drunk on the job. I was sent to cover a big 5-alarm fire in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And I was driving my car along an elevator train, you know, back in New York, you had those elevator trains, you know. And I forgot that at Bedford Avenue went back underground and became a subway. I just kept going straight ahead into a cement stanchion, you know. Drunk as a skunk, wound up in Jewish hospital, came to in the emergency room. I had a big rubber thing in my mouth because I had lost some of my teeth, spit out half of my tongue, and they were wiring up my jaw and stitching me up. And you come to out of blackouts in strange places, don't we, Jessica? Not that I know. it's just generally speaking, you know. And then I went home a couple of weeks later, and my father, you know, invited all of my friends to come visit me at his house. You know how alcoholics love to visit the sick and bury the dead as long as there's a bottle around, you know? And the bottle was being passed around. And when it came to me, my father grabbed it from me. He says, "You shouldn't have any hard stuff with that wired up jaw, you know?" So he handed me a bottle of Christian Brothers Sherry Wine. He said, "This will be very soothing for your pain." Well, you know, if you cluck enough Christian Brothers Sherry Wine through a wired up jaw, you can get pretty drunk. And you can get pretty sick. That's sweet stuff. And if you ever tried to puke through a wired-up jaw, from experience, I can tell you the big pieces come out of your ears, you know. So I swore off Christian Brothers Sherry Wine, and I continued on my merry way. Along the way, I got enough courage to get engaged twice, the second, different girls, different times, and the second time I got engaged, I didn't even like the girl, really. I mean, I her brother was a drinking buddy of mine, and we were drinking one night in Monahan Saloon, and he said to me, "Would you like to meet my sister?" And I said, "I'll meet your sister." So I met his sister, and next thing I know, I'm engaged. Maybe one of those blackouts. I mean, you know, hope you don't mind my laughing at this stuff, but it's funny now, you know. But this is the way it was. I was an egotistical, arrogant, self-centered, selfish son of a bee. And that's what I was as an alcoholic. And I try not to be that way. I try not to be that way today. Anyway, I met Patty. And next day, as I said, my mother liked her. I think she even told you, didn't she, Bernadette? Yeah. Yeah, my mother liked her. And so now I'm engaged. And I don't love this girl. And how do you get out of it? I mean, how do you really get out of it? Plus the fact that I should mention her father was a police captain and he carried a gun. Plus he had put $1,500 down on the hall. I mean, he wanted to get rid of her as much as her brother did. Anyway, but she was a nice girl. She was a nice girl. I think she was a nice girl. Anyway, she was a nice girl. An opportunity arose. We were invited to an afternoon wedding in New Jersey. And Patty said to me, "I'll pick you up at Manhattan Police Headquarters, where I was covering that weekend, and we'll drive to New Jersey." And she said, "And don't drink. There'll be plenty to drink in New Jersey." I said, "Fine." So by the time she arrived at 10 o'clock that morning, I was 3 sheets to the wind. And I fell into the car, I looked in the back seat, and there was this girl in the back seat named Frances. And she was gorgeous. She was absolutely gorgeous. But she looked kind of sad. And I used to think it was a mortal sin for pretty girls to look sad, you know? So I started cheering her up, you know? And by the time we got to New Jersey, we were good friends, Frances and I, you know? And then I found out Frances liked to drink like I did, and we got drunk together. I got re-drunk, she got drunk. And all I remember is my fiancé screaming at me that I'm making a fool out of her, you know? But this was my opportunity. What the hell? Anyway, next thing I know, I come out of another blackout. And I'm back in Queens, New York, in this big dance hall. And it was a German dance hall, and they had a big Oompa band. I don't know, maybe you don't know it, but you know what an Oompa band is, right? Yeah. And that's a big German hand, big tubas and all that kind of stuff. And they're playing this German music. And I'm in the middle of the floor with Francis, right? And there's a big crowd circling around us, clapping their hands. And Frances is going nuts. She's with this music, you know, and she's twirling around, and she takes off her jacket and she throws it up in the air. I figure that's part of the dance. Took off my jacket, threw it up in the air, you know. Next thing you know, Frances takes off her blouse and throws it up in the air. So I got my shirt and tie, throw it up in the air. Everybody's clapping louder and louder and louder. Music's getting louder. And finally, Frances takes off her skirt. She throws it up in the air. So I drop my drawers, you know. And here I am dancing around in my skivvies, and my engagement ring comes flying in over the crowd. You know. She broke off our engagement, you know. I mean, it wasn't me. Oh, man. Anyway, by the way, she wound up happily married to some probably straight guy. Anyway, not that I wasn't at the time. Anyway, no, as a matter of fact, I always have been, right? Come to think of it. Anyway, where the hell am I going with this? I never know where I'm going. And but I'll get there. Primacy, I'll get there. Anyway, I put my pants on, I get dressed, I go back over to this joint in Queens, Gallagher's, right? Gallagher's, to show my friends I'm a free man, right? Have a couple of drinks, more drinks. And in the back room of Gallagher's, they have a dance hall, and I go back to ask a girl to dance, and there are two girls sitting at the table. And I don't even remember this part, but you told me this part. I went, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, right? Well, you eeny, meeny, miny, mo, I don't remember, you know? You won, Bernadette won, yeah. So I asked her to dance, and 3.5 weeks later, we danced off to Elkton, Maryland to get married. That was then the elopement capital of the world, Elkton, Maryland, yeah. Well, actually, what happened is I was taking her home one night, 3.5 weeks later. I used to try to get her home by midnight so I could have 4 hours by myself to drink, you know. And this night she said, I don't want to go home right now. I said, what do you want to do? She says, I'd like to stay with you. And it had been so long since anybody said that to me. I said, okay, let's get married. She said, okay. So we drive to Elkton, Maryland. 51 years ago? Christ, I don't, it's that long? Ooh, wow. They made cars back then? Yeah. Okay. So, but I do remember this. We got to Elkton and she said she was hungry. So I drove into town and I bought her an 8-cent loaf of Wonder Bread and a half a pound of bologna. And I bought a quarter for roses for myself. God bless you. Now, Bernadette didn't know I was an alcoholic, and I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I had no idea. And that's how we got married. That's how alcoholics live. Bernadette didn't know it, and I didn't know it. And then I dragged this beautiful lady from a lovely Italian family right down with me into the degradation of alcoholism over the next 8.5 years. And I mean down. Bernadette comes from a family of 16, and her mother was, God rest her soul, a very, very religious lady. And by the way, there's only one boy in the whole family. He's passed on now. His name was Anthony. And I remember asking Anthony once, what is it like growing up with all those sisters? You know what he said to me? He said, I didn't know until I was 13 that I didn't have to sit down to pee. You know, so that's the kind of family it was, you know. The first time I went over there for Sunday dinner, I got a nickname from my mother-in-law, Doozy Potts. If anybody's here, it means you're nuts. That's what it means, you know. First Sunday dinner, I'm Doozy Potts. Okay. And as I say, I was progressing at this point on my job at the newspaper, and then all of a sudden I started degressing I wound up getting fired 5 times and wound up as the obituary editor. You know, that's where you come in at 3 o'clock in the morning and you're supposed to call a funeral homes to find out what well-known people dropped dead that night. And I was too busy to do that because I was over in Mucci's Saloon hanging one on with Frank Mucci. I used to drink a lot of famous, real drunks joints. Mucci's, Cuckoo's, Tootie's. Remember Tootie's? The lady that attended bar had a beard. Remember that? Famous place. Anyway, she did. She had a beard. I felt like shaving her every time I got drunk. Oh, man. Anyway. Oh. Having fun, right? We bought a home, a two-family house. My mother-in-law got the money together and gave it to us to put down a two-family home in a lovely community called Floral Park. We were getting $95 rent upstairs, and our mortgage payment was only $70, and I couldn't keep up the payments. I always had a tough job handling money. I never met an alcoholic that had an easy time with it. I don't know. I got to tell you, by the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I owed 4 finance companies, 3 banks, 2 loan sharks, and my Aunt Jenny, you know. And Aunt Jenny was the only one that was willing to wait. You know? Not to skip around, but I don't want to. I was sharing with somebody about my. I had one of my loan sharks, his name Richie Baldino. Not a great name for a loan shark? Richie Baldino. He was a short, stocky, heavyset guy that walked around with a cane. Well, it was more than a cane, it was like an Irish shillelagh. And every time he'd find me in Mucci's, he would say, I'm going to break your legs. I owed him $17,000. I never borrowed that much money from him, but the vigorish, you know, the vig. We were talking about that over at dinner tonight. And the reason I'm mentioning that is because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and finally became to get sober, I found out that Richie died of a heart attack. And I mentioned it to my sponsor. I said, what am I going to do? Because my loan shark, Richie Baldino, just died of a heart attack. And I owe him $17,500. What should I do? And my sponsor said, pray for him. And that's how God, you know, God works wonders in this program. if you're sitting here tonight with a serious problem you don't think you can get rid of, just say a little prayer and God will find some way to do it for you. All he did was simply take Richie Baldino to, you know, loan shark heaven. And I mention it because that's my way of, as Benny said, my sponsor, praying for Richie Baldino. I have made up for whatever in many, many other ways in my life so far. But it did really take a big burden off me at the time. I wasn't afraid to walk out the front door anymore. Anyway, so we're married. I'm now obituary editor, so I'm not even being honest on that job. I'm over at Mucci's, and so to cover myself, I would use to tear out the obituaries from other newspapers and paste them up and send them into the composer room. This was the days before computer type, you know. And so I used to get letters in my box from the editor saying, we want fresh obits, because the ones you're sending in are people who died 2 or 3 days ago, you know. And when I sent one in of a guy that died about 10 days ago, I knew I was going to get fired. So I quit. And I got a job working for a magazine. I began to travel all over the country, big expense account. Wherever I went, I got drunk. That job only lasted me 3.5 years because I turned in a phony story and they were going to fire me and I quit. And then I got a job working for a radio station, writing radio shows. And that didn't last very long. And then I got a job in the PR business and that lasted 6 months. And I was going downhill real fast financially. We had to sell the two-family house to pay off the bills that Bernadette knew about. We bought a small one-family house, and the bank took that away. And so by 1960, I guess it was, huh, we moved into Mama's house. We moved into my mother-in-law's house and moved in. We had 4 kids by then, and we moved into her basement. And it was just a, you know, dirty old, it wasn't dirty, it was just a cement wall basement. And we set up cribs around the walls for the kids, and Bernadette and I slept on 2 cots behind the oil burner. And that's where I dragged my family. And I hated that basement. And one of the reasons I hated that basement is because to get to it, I had to go through the side door and down the steps. But to go down the steps, I had to pass the dining room. And my mother-in-law was always at the dining room table saying her prayers. My mother-in-law was a great prayer. She had 2 sets of rosary beads, a stack of prayer cards that big, the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the lives of the saints. And she was always praying. And the thing is, I knew she was praying for me, and that ticked me off. And I would stand there, and I would scream at her, stay out of my life. I don't need you in my life. Stay out of my life. I don't care. You know. And Mama would just keep on praying. This woman never castigated me for what she saw I was doing to her wife. She was an incredible lady. Incredible lady, and I hated it. I hated it. I hated it, you know, at that time. And I hated to go down in the basement. So I go back out and drink. One night, I was in a Third Avenue bar. And by this time, I weighed about 300. I've never been a light man, but I weighed about 310 pounds. As I said this afternoon, I used to get beat up by 100-pound guys. And I'm sitting in a Third Avenue saloon, and a thought occurred to me, because I used to get scared once in a while. You know the fears, you know, what's happening, what's going on, where am I going? I was 27 years old, and my life was a mess. I didn't know where I was going anymore. I was living on borrowed money. I had a wife I thought hated my guts. She didn't. I had children who were afraid of me, I think they were. I hated myself. I hated everybody. I hated everybody. Because everybody had it better than me. Everybody's getting breaks but me, you know. I hated God because God wasn't doing anything for me anymore. Not that I ever did anything for him. And suddenly the thought occurred to me, you must be nuts. You had these wonderful jobs. You had your name in the paper. You had all going for you. You got a wife and kids. You had homes, cars. What happened? And the thought suddenly occurred to me I was nuts or going nuts. And that made a lot of sense to me. It explained why I was doing all the things I was doing over and over and over and over again. I had no idea that I was powerless over alcohol. That once I picked up that first drink, I could not stop. I had no idea. And so I made a mistake. And I came home and I told my wife, I think I'm going crazy. And she called up our family doctor. And the following Saturday afternoon, because Bernadette's a woman of action, and following Saturday afternoon, she had me sitting in front of a psychiatrist, a Dr. John Brancato in Queens. And I really was looking forward to going to see him because I thought maybe he'll tell me what's wrong with me and I really will do what he tells me to do, and in a few weeks I'll be okay. In fact, I felt so good about going to see him, I stopped off at Fred Funk's Bar and Grill to get ready. You know, this is a big moment in my life, you know. I'm going to get straightened out finally. And so I had a few shooters and a few beer chases, you know, and then I feel much better now, and I'm ready to see the psychiatrist. And when I walked into his office, by the way, two nuns walked out, Catholic nuns. Back in those days, they used to wear their full habits. And I remember thinking to myself, if nuns got to see a psychiatrist, I mustn't be that bad, you know. So I walked in, and he sat me in front of his desk. He didn't have a couch, which made me nervous. I thought I was going to lay on a psychiatrist's couch and tell him how, you know, my life was terrible and all that stuff. But he had no couch. I didn't know if he was a real psychiatrist or not, you know. He sat me in front of his desk. So I sat in a chair in front of his desk. I laid my belly on his desk. He told me later on I looked like Porky Pig with a hangover. You know, so he had no bedside manner. And he said to me, why are you here? I said, because I think I'm crazy. He said, why? And I began to tell him, you know, the troubles that I was having. And he began to ask me why I was having these troubles. And we got into conversation, you know. And all of a sudden, he's asking me about my drinking, you know. He said, what do you drink? You drink a lot? I said, oh, I don't drink a lot, you know. He said, well, what do you mean by a lot? You drink a few beers with the boys on weekends? I said, yeah. He said, well, do you ever drink beer on Mondays or Tuesdays? I said, oh, yeah, yeah. How about Wednesdays, Thursdays, or Fridays? I said, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. He said, well, do you drink any rye? I said, yeah, I drink rye. You know, do you ever drink any scotch? I said, oh, yeah, I drink scotch. Do you ever drink any wine? I said, yeah, I drink wine. But I don't drink Christian Brothers sherry wine, I remember saying to him. You know, I remember telling him that. But what he did is, or tried to do, is to paint a picture of a guy who was 27 years old who drank every day in the week anything he could get his hands on. And then he said to me, Bill, do you know what an alcoholic is? And I straightened myself up because I knew the answer to this one, you know. And I said, yes, I do. And I described the guy on the Bowery. Because in my mind, that's the alcoholic. And he said to me, Bill, that guy wasn't born down on the Bowery. He was probably born in a nice place like you, maybe even a nicer place like you. And through the use and abuse of alcohol, he wound up on the Bowery. And then he began to talk to me about the disease of alcoholism. I found out later this guy was an Air Force psychiatrist, and he knew all about this disease of alcoholism. I was very fortunate to be there. But suddenly, I got the impression that he was insinuating that I might be an alcoholic, and I got pissed off. I really did. I mean, it bothered me a great deal. Because in Fred Funk's, I made a promise with myself that I was going to tell him the whole truth and nothing but the truth, and now he's insulting me by calling me or suggesting I'm an alcoholic, and I stopped listening. But when it was all over, he said to me, if you are an alcoholic, I can't help you. And I think you are. But he said, I know some people who can help you. And he gave me the phone number of the Integral Office of AA in New York City. He said, if you really want help, call these people up and go see them. But he says, if you're not sure, he says, don't come back to me because it costs $25 a visit. This was in 1961. And he said, if you want to keep on drinking, you're going to need the money. He was a very straight guy, you know. Very straight guy. So I left his office, and, you know, how do you go home and tell your wife that a psychiatrist thinks you're an alcoholic? Anyway, I did, and I went over to New York. I'll never forget it. I walked into the Integral office, and there was a guy. It was a Saturday afternoon, about 4 or 5 o'clock. There was a guy sitting at the desk, well-dressed guy, and his name was John. He stuck his hand out, and he says, I'm John. I said, oh, hi, John, I'm Bill. He says, do you have a problem with alcohol? I said, no. I said, but there's a psychiatrist back in Queens that thinks I do. And he sent me over here for some information. He said, okay. He said, would you like to go to an AA meeting? I said, yeah, okay. I thought maybe you made an appointment, you know, like maybe like a week from Thursday or something, you know? I said, yeah, okay, fine, John. He said, well, how about tonight? I said, tonight? Oh, no, I'm too busy tonight. I had nothing to do tonight but drink. And he said, okay, and this is Hollywood stuff. He handed me his card. And he said, anytime you want to go to an AA meeting, just call me up and I'll take you. I said, thank you, John. And I started to leave, but I looked at his card. And it said, John so-and-so, vice president of Chase Manhattan Bank. And I was running a little short. I don't know about you, but I used to think I was the great manipulator, you know? I said, geez, maybe I ought to get to know John. So I turned around and I said, John, yes, where would you like to go tonight, John? And that's how God, who knows us alcoholics so well, got me to my first AA meeting. And took me out to Garden City, Long Island, and they told me, sat in the front row. You know, we're very mean to newcomers. You know, we sit them in the front row. And he said, just listen and try to identify. I don't know what the hell that meant, because the guy that spoke weighed about 110 pounds. I weighed 310. How do you identify with a guy like that, you know? After the meeting, they gather around you, you know, and they said, where do you live? And because we'll let you know where your home group is so you can go to your meeting in your neighborhood. I said, well, you know, I told them I lived in Richmond Hill, but I wasn't going to tell them I could not go to a meeting in Richmond Hill because I didn't want anybody to see me going to AA. Nah, you know, alcoholic pride, right? I never used to think that they used to see me Saturday afternoons urinating on their hedges, you know, but, you know, but I didn't want them to see me getting sober, you know, it's nuts. We are. I mean, I don't know about you, but I was. No, you probably were too. Anyway, so I went 3 miles out of my way to the Woodhaven group. I stayed around. It took me about 3 months. And I'm saying this, sharing this for the newcomers. Because if you're comparing yourself to me, you're wasting your time. If you're identifying yourself with how I felt going through all of this, then maybe you got a chance. Because I compared myself with people who had gone further, who had done things I hadn't done, all that kind of stuff. If you don't want to be an alcoholic, you don't have to be. You can just die from it. And I almost did, because I left AA, and a year later I was sitting on a window ledge of the Margarita Hotel on East 21st Street in New York, ready to jump, because at 28, my life was over. I had now lost everything, including my self-respect. I hated myself. I couldn't live with myself, what I had done to my family, my children, everybody who tried to help me, and God. I not only had God in my life, I just felt God had nothing, didn't want anything more to do with me. The self-pity of alcoholism. And I looked down, but I didn't want to die. I didn't want to die. I just didn't know how to live. We don't want to die. We just don't know how to live. This program shows us how to live. But I looked down, and as I said, there was wires crisscrossing this air shaft. There was an air shaft in between buildings, you know. And you know those buildings in New York. And they were all telephone lines, crisscross. I couldn't find a clear spot. You know, I figured if I jumped, I'll have to hit a wire on the way down and hurt myself, you know. Nuts. So I came back home and told Bernie I was going to leave her. She'd be better off without me. She got on welfare, all that kind of stuff. And she didn't yell. She didn't holler. She just looked at me and she said, "Do you think you owe me one last favor before you go?" And I said, "Yeah, I guess so." She said, "For God's sakes, Bill, why don't you give AA another try?" A woman I thought hated my guts. And so I went out and had a few drinks to think about it. I came back in and the phone was ringing in my mother-in-law's apartment. And it was for me, somebody that Bernard had called. It's a guy named Joe. And he said to me, "I hear you're having troubles again, Bill. Would you like to give AA another try?" And I said, "Please, Joe." And the following night, April 8th, 1962, they picked me up. When I say they, a guy named Benny Michelson, Johnny Grimes, Joe, and they brought me back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been here ever since. Through the grace of God and you. Because that's what we do here. We help each other. The unconditional love of one drunk for another is what's kept me here. Because I found out you didn't ask me any questions about who I was, what I did, or anything else. It was, "Do you want to stay sober?" And I said I did. And Benny Michelson, a Jewish jeweler from Brooklyn, became my sponsor. And he said to me very simply, "Bill, if you don't drink, you got a chance. If you don't drink, if you don't drug, you got a chance." And I wanted a chance. And I decided I'd do whatever Benny said. And I became attached to the hip of Benny Michelson. Wherever Benny went, I went. You know, when I didn't have any place to go and I was afraid to stay at home or walk the streets, I went up to his jewelry store. He was a Jewish jeweler from Brooklyn. And I'd sit in his back shop watching him repair watches as he shared with me his experience and his knowledge of this program. And he kept me sober. This Jewish jeweler from Brooklyn brought me to a Catholic AA retreat where I did the third and fourth steps and the fifth step. And Benny's passed on now. I've had another sponsor since. Bob knows one of my other sponsors, Jimmy Grennan from California. And when Jimmy died, Leo became my sponsor. Leo got sick. Now I have a sponsor named George, South Carolina, who's very nervous. Anyway. He says, "You mean all your sponsors died?" You know. He said, "I guess I'll give it a shot." I don't know what the hell. Anyway, I began to grow in Alcoholics Anonymous. Benny said to me, "The only way to stay sober is to change. You cannot expect to stay sober the kind of person you are. You have to change, and I'll show you how." And here's how. He took me through these 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I admitted for the first time in my life that I was an alcoholic. I was powerless over alcohol. I came to realize that if I took the first drink, I could not guarantee what was going to happen to me. I couldn't guarantee if I was going to go home that night or the next night or the next week. I couldn't guarantee once I took the first drink if I was going to have a job to go back to, a home to go back to, a wife and kids to go back to. That was being powerless over alcohol. The first drink of alcohol. Anyway, the first drink is too many and 1,000 aren't enough, as we say. So I began to change. I get into the steps, I began to change. And then we moved from New York to Nashville, Tennessee. Because even in a big city like New York, a writer like myself could get a bad reputation, and I had a hell of a bad reputation. And so in Nashville, Tennessee, we started our whole life all over again, right? Brand new life. We had 4 kids when we moved to Nashville. We had 9 when we left. Well, you know, a lot of things begin to work again when you sober up, you know. Just in case anybody needs to hear that, newcomers. Anyway, and then we left Nashville, we moved to Cleveland, another job, came back to New York, started my own company, and they wound up getting into business for myself, as I say. And then I merged with 3 other guys into an entertainment business, and But in the meantime, Alcoholics Anonymous became the most important thing in my life. When I say became, Benny said to me early on, and I'm going to say it to those who are new or coming back, and all of us who are here, we all know it, that if we make Alcoholics Anonymous the first thing in our life, we can have a fantastic life. But if we don't, we'll have no life at all. He said to me, Bill, if you make AA the first thing in your life, you can have second things, third things, 50th things, 20, 1,000 things. But if you don't, you'll have no life at all. And it's true. And I'm living proof of it. And everybody here is living proof of it. And at my age, I know, being sober in AA, the best is yet to come. Yet to come. And it's true for everyone here who is sober. So I got in the movie business, and I'd like to share this last thing with you because this is my God story, and I'll close with that. We all have God stories. We all have situations in our life that God takes care of because we can't take care of them ourselves. I got a big head because I got into the movie business, and we were three partners, and they were very good at the business. I was a novice, but I learned a lot from them. And we began making movies, managing talent, making movies. And we made like Kansas City Bomber with Raquel Welch. I remember watching Raquel Welch skating around this roller derby rink with black, tight-fitting leather pants. It's like having a spiritual awakening. It's incredible. And then a friend of mine, Peter Morris, who had worked for the Herald Tribune when I was working for the Journal, wrote a book about a dirty cop, or a guy who turned in dirty cops, and wrote a book about it. We bought the rights to the book, and we made a movie called Serpico. And then we made a movie called Dirty Afternoon. And then it was my turn, I thought, and I said to my partners, I want to make a movie about Alcoholics Anonymous. By this time, Bernard had introduced me to Lois. I had met Bill before he passed away, and Lois became Bernadette's friend and my friend for the last 14 years of her life. And I'll wrap this up very quickly before you raise the sign. And Roland Lois gave me permission to write the story of how Alcoholics Anonymous got started, told me the story of her and her husband, and we made a movie called My Name is Bill W., which starred James Woods, James Garner, and Joe Beth Williams, and which won all kinds. Woods, Jimmy, the Best Actor Award. And I share all this with you because everything in my life, every single thing in my life, including that wonderful woman there, is because of you and Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything. It's not anything but the truth. And that's all I know is the truth. And finally, the best way I can describe what happened to me is the day that my mother-in-law came down. We were living in Nashville, and we were having, I don't know, fifth or sixth. And he can now take care of Bernard and the kids. And one night, the kids were in bed. Bernard was in bed, and I was getting ready to do some writing, and Mama came into the den. She sat down next to me with all of her prayer cards and her rosary beads. She was all set to go, you know. She put her hand on my shoulder. I never will forget it. Mama was just a little short thing. Just a walking woman of love. And she looked up at me and she said to me, you know, Bill, all of my life, she was 76 then, I think, all of my life, I've been reading about the life of Jesus and all the miracles that he did and the lives of the saints and all the miracles that they did. And she said, I've often wondered what it would be like to witness a miracle. And then she looked at me and she said, and now I have. Mama saw it more before I even recognized it. And that's what we all are sitting here tonight. We all are Mama's miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank you for letting me share my story with you. Thank you.